Afternoon, everyone, excuse me. Welcome to Senate Finance. It is about 1:25. It's Monday, March 28th. Present at the table are Senators Machicki, Dunleavy, Olson, and Hoffman. Senators McKinnon and Bishop are both traveling. And I think Senator Bishop will be here in a little bit. Is Senator McKinnon? Senator Coghill, if you would like to approach the mic, we're going to go through a fairly high altitude overview of SB 91, also known as the crime bill. And if you could just walk us through this, Senator Coghill, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, before you is the CS for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 91, Judiciary Committee. The version S is the version that I think that found its way to you. The Senate Bill 91 is an effort that is being culminated in the work that began in another legislative session under Senate Bill 64 that put the Commission, Criminal Justice Commission, together to bring recommendations to the legislature on sentencing reform, recidivism reduction, public safety elements. And so they did. The commission met over the last year or so. I think probably a variety of meetings that I think there were seven major commission meetings. There were probably dozens of subcommittee meetings that came up with 21 recommendations. And I know that we passed on to committee members the commission report. I don't know that I'm going to go through the whole thing with you, but I think I should hit some highlights with you. But just to give you an idea of the members on the commission, we had a Supreme Court Justice, Justice Brenner, we had Gary Folger from Department of Public Safety, Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust, Representative Keller, myself, Commissioner Monaghan at the time from the Department of Corrections. We had a judge, Stephanie Rhodes, Attorney General Richards, Lieutenant Chris Sell, who's here today, Brendan Stanfill, Quinlan Steiner, and Judge Tark Stevens down from this lower area here in the southeast. The goal was to get the commission to bring us information on how to reduce recidivism, keeping Alaska safe. And whenever you hear the word recidivism, if you have more recidivism, more people going back to jail, that's more crime. If you can reduce recidivism, have less people going back to jail, that's less crime. And that's just the facts. So how do you hold people accountable if jail may not be the best way? How do you control correction spending? We just built a prison that was well over $300 million. We have our costs are going up at a rate that we will not be able to sustain. So cost is definitely one of the issues. But it does not trump public safety, and I think the people should know. So we had 13 members on the commission. They met over a period of 7 months, and they came up with 21 recommendations that showed that we could reduce the state's daily prison population by 20%, 21% over the next 10 years, and save, under their recommendations, some $424 million. And they were high level. They were consensus-based discussions, and they came around these issues. Now, in your packet, you should have a sheet that I use. This is just helpful to me, and it's color-coded. It puts them in categories that they dealt with. It talks about the policy that's in that category. The recommendation that is put forward by the commission, and the place that it actually resides in the bill section. So this is one of the ways that was helpful to me, because as I just talked earlier before I got here, this bill does not fit very well into my bumper sticker. This deals with several major policy areas. from the way we arrest people, to the way we hold them accountable in pretrial, to the way sentencing happens, to the way we supervise them once they've been jailed, incarcerated, done their time, and maybe got some good time, and they're on community supervision. And there are other reentry issues, including some of the victims' rights issues that will be addressed. So pretrial sentencing, community supervision, and a major other post-incarceration issues. The commission recommended that rather than arresting people, that we should go to the presumption of citation. They recommended that we take B misdemeanors and turn them into citation only and not arrest. That did not work too well, so going through the last two committees, citation is still a preference, but on anything that is a crime that you need to get people away from a circumstance, we have changed that in the, under the B misdemeanors. But what we did do under pretrial that I think is going to be a significant shift in Alaska, and it's a new concept in our policy, and that is on when you release somebody if they've been arrested, right now you can get bail, go to a bail schedule, and be out pretty much the next day. The commission recommended a risk-based decision-making on release and taking it from the cost of a bail to the value of the bail. And let me just give you one example how that might work. You might have somebody that's a high-risk person who can afford to get out on bail and be out the next day. You might have somebody who's very, very low-risk who cannot afford the bail and may sit through jail when really there was no great need for that. So if you do a risk-based release decision-making process, all of a sudden now instead of being on the value of a dollar, it's on the value of the risk. The risk is twofold. One is, will they show back up for court? And is there a risk to society generally? And I think those two are very, very important. And because of that, we've put together a pretrial supervision, and that's going to be in your fiscal notes. You're going to see a pretrial service officers, but that is going to create pretrial supervision. If you can get somebody diverted into a program under an ankle monitor because of drugs or alcohol, then your chances of danger to society, the benefits of changing people's choices, all work to the betterment of public safety, and less criminal issues. Under sentencing, we looked at the B misdemeanors, the A misdemeanors. We looked at the unclassified felonies, the classified felonies like B, A, and C. And we looked at some of the controlled substances. In here, you're going to see some of those recommendations. And rather than going through all of those, I just want to let you know it was thoughtful, it was complex, both at the committee, the commission level, and at the committee level. And so the discretionary parole and administrative parole is one of the new concepts in this law, is administrative parole. You'll see that it has taken some benefits, and we've also put some better sideboards on it through the committee process. The geriatric parole, by the way, which if I was incarcerated, I guess I would be considered geriatric now. But there are, it's a proven, and I think this is one of the places where we took great, many places in this, we took great interest in some of the research that we've had throughout America. And this is one place where we found that the recidivism rate is way low and the risk is way low. And I think you're going to see, except for some sex offenses, that is a policy that will work. Sex offender treatment, I'll just say briefly that the sex offender treatment right now is happening too much outside of the jail system. And it is a requirement for sex offenders. If we can reinvest some of the savings that we've got here, we can do these sex offender treatments inside the jail, consequently a safer public. And that's just not happening right now. We might have people languishing in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau for months, sometimes years, waiting for them to get into sex offender treatment, not able to go back home, and certainly that treatment has been proven very effective. So so pretrial, the things that we do in jail, one of the things that probably you won't see too much here is instead of just marking time in jail and getting credit for that, now we're saying if you will complete programs and do things in jail to earn good time, that there's real value to that. That shows if you're a model that there is value to being a model prisoner. The whole idea there is if you can return to society being more productive rather than just marking time in jail, 95% of the people in jail are going to be back on the streets. And so what's going to change between the time they get in and the time they get out? This allows them incentives to do the best they can to be a more productive citizen. The same thing is true on probation, parole, on everything from good time on electronic monitoring to how we work with the CRCs. And the CRCs are your halfway houses. We put requirements in here that is ramping up the need for treatment and the accountability and some of the way we contract with the community centers that are halfway houses. A couple of things that are in the bill that have been added along the way is outside of recommendations, you'll see that we worked with public assistance on if you're convicted of a drug offense and you're going to be on public assistance, that you do random drug testing. That was put in state affairs. That's a new concept in our law and will be challenged to some degree. And I'm looking for maybe better answers along the way. But I think that it's defensible, and it's gone through now two committees, defensible. The big thing is, what do you do on a failure rate if there is a way to include that in reapplication? So working on that. The victims' rights issue in this bill have followed it from the inception. When we put the commission together, we put victims' advocates on the commission. We had two round table discussions with victim advocacy groups during the commission, and I'm a member of the commission, so I got to be a part of that. I'm a non-voting member, so I was mostly listening, assimilating, learning, and growing. But from that time until now, in the State Affairs Committee, you'll see the victims' rights have been probably ramped up even better yet. So some of the things that we've done in both the State Affairs and the Senate Judiciary Committee have helped us put this bill, I'd say, in better shape. One of them is, if somebody's on probation parole, does the victim have the right to speak up at that parole hearing? Under the administrative parole and under the regular parole, we're shortening down the times for probation parole, but we're also adding voices. That one of the voices is the victim, and one of the voices is the people in the corrections facilities. We're asking them to have input on that parole. Though we're shortening down the time, I think the accountability measures are going to be very clear. They're programmatic, they're evidence-based. So we've limited some of the things we've changed in here. I probably won't go through any more. Probably on the sex offender earned good time, they had when we first introduced this, they were given earned good time credit for complying with their sex treatment at one-third. It was moved down to one-fifth in the last committee referral. I still think we should have good time earned only in that there has to be incentive for them to be able to complete their programs. And I think that's one of the things that will help us do that. So the reinvestment in this is a big deal. I think $142 a day is what it costs to put somebody in jail. And if we can hold them accountable outside of jail, the marginal savings could be that $42, maybe even more. If we can keep them from returning to jail, that's even better yet, because we have a better and safer public. But some of the reinvestment could actually turn out very well. You're going to see in one of your fiscal notes from the Office of Management and Budget that they estimate the total savings could be $150 million over the next 5 years with some of the recommendations they put together. And my expectation, as you'll hear from both OMB and the Pew group, who have taken some of the data and run it through Alaska statistics.
Senator Coghill, if you could pause just for a moment. Senator Dunleavy?
Just a quick question. On the those charged with sexual abuse crimes, it's a very large category. encompassing many different types of offenses, from, you know, crimes against young children to I'm not sure what the exactly what the law is now, but a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old dating type of situation. Are you going to, when you go through this, is there going to be a discussion about how that's broken down? Because, for example, some of those, quote, offenses, those individuals, from a, I don't know, psychotherapy perspective, their crimes may be, again, an individual older than the minimum age of 2 or 3 years dating somebody who they later on get married and have a family, everything works out, but there's something still on the record, to a child molester who is a repeat offender. When we go through the bill, are you going to, those categories separated out and treat it differently?
The answer is yes, and I think you bring up a very good point. One of the problems that we've had is under probation, having one size fit everybody. And this is having a risk assessment tool that is going to be involved in those earning good time or getting probation parole. And I think you're exactly right. There are going to be those who just cannot get there because of the nature of their crime. And there are going to be some that because of the nature of their crime and the risk assessment tool is going to be valuable. And it's how you hold them accountable under probation parole. So I think the answer is yes. That you'll see that as we go through the bill.
Hey, just one follow-up to the chair. You'll have at least one category that's probably a pathology. In other words, it's so deeply rooted and deep. There's some serious issues there that it's probably got to be treated totally different than, like I said, somebody that may have had a boyfriend or girlfriend that was underage and they went on to have a life together, that there was no pathology related to that per se, as there is with some of your other cases. But anyway, I just wanted to know. That's going to be treated differently or looked at differently.
It's a category that will be looked at. There are many categories, and that's why I say this one doesn't fit well into just a simple statement, because you're looking at what the commission came up with after months of deliberation and deep research. You're looking at the implementation of evidence-based pretrial services, focusing on prison beds that are serious and for violent offenders, strengthening probation, parole, supervision, very, very different than what we've been doing, improve the opportunities for reentry, which I know that if we are going to have a safer public, we have to reinvest some of the savings into the reentry programs, and that's everything from licensing to the way we hold people accountable under probation, parole, including the length of time, in my view. So the reinvestment is everything from victim services to treatment and driver's licenses, I think. So the whole idea here of the bill is to protect the public safety. That's paramount. That's what we raised our hand to do, is to uphold the Constitution. Our correction system is very important because it's meant to be corrections, but it's also to validate community condemnation. In our Constitution, we also have a victims' rights constitutional amendment that I think is totally important, and it also deals with the rights of the victims and the public condemnation. It's also true that we have civil liberties issue, that people are innocent until they're proven guilty, and they're still human beings, and they're to be treated accordingly. And the way we treat them in our arresting, our pretrial, is very, very important to me. Once a jury of their peers convicts them, then they should be held to the standard that they were held to. One of the problems we have right now, I think, that our recidivism rate is two-thirds. That means two-thirds of the people going out of jail are coming back. This is not acceptable. It's not a safe society. So we've got to think of ways to do it differently. So the commission came up with some new concepts. But there are new concepts to Alaska. There are proven concepts throughout the United States. So we took the best we could across the United States, places like Texas, who have reinvested in their population, have actually had a lower crime rate, reduced their jail population at the same time. If they can do it, that means it can be done. They're not the only place that have done it. There's been over two dozen states that have invested in it. That's probably one of the more dramatic states, but on every place that has done a serious look at, like we are really across the board look from the arrest all the way up to our social service agencies that are doing services for those who have behavioral health issues, who have drug and alcohol issues, who now have barriers to being in the workforce, and to victims who have many times lost their voice. So I think this bill is comprehensive in that regard. That's one of the reasons why it's so hard to describe. And it's easy to pick one section out and try to apply it to the failing of our present-day system and say you're making it worse under this law because you're not taking into account the accountability measures from the arrest, pre-trial, all the way to the post-conviction, the time that they're in jail to get good time, what they can do in society to be better and more productive. Those who won't be, they're going to end up in jail. Those who are not safe to be in public should be in jail. And this bill kind of pushes it in that direction. So if you have sign points here, it is to hold those accountable who should be accountable. And for those who can be productive, let them be productive. If there's community condemnation, I think we still have a lot of latitude in here for judges to do that. Even in pretrial, we are allowing for aggravating and mitigating circumstances for these risk assessments. So this is to show that it's a risk-based assessment. And I think the commission did well. And so what you have here is a very lengthy bill that has both effective dates, applications, court rule changes, and we'll go through that in order. The court rule changes are because quite often we're changing the way the court does things. Quite often we're actually taking discretion away from the courts on the swift certain elements where we want somebody to go back to jail because they failed. They go right back to jail. We keep the time shorter, but we also make it mandated. We take some discretion. There are other places where we give the judges much more discretion, and it's to be based on the accountability measures they have in front of them. There are some tools in here that they haven't had previously, and I think that that's going to be helpful all along through our whole justice system. And it's my aim that as we go through this, that we will have a look back on it. So in the last committee referral, we not only put reinvestment language in there, but we asked the commission to extend itself out to 2020 and to look over what we're doing to make sure that it actually happens the way that we envisioned it happening. So I think you'll see a complete package here. It's comprehensive. It has many, many facets to it. You'll be able to talk to anywhere from policemen to victims, from the judges to the prosecutors, from the defenders to the prisoners themselves, to talk about how this is going to treat people honestly, fairly, and as justly as we can go in our society. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I think that's the overview of what we're doing here. And I think now it would be probably very difficult unless I went into section by section detail. I can tell you that I have another cheat sheet that I use that actually shows every code of law, and I think Senator Machicki has this, every code of law that this particular bill fits. It's Title 11 in several chapters. It's Title 12 in several chapters. Title 28 in a couple of chapters. It's Title 29, Title 23, Title 34, Title 43. As you can see, this bill goes across many, many sections of the law that we dealt with. It deals with direct and indirect court rule amendments, and it has timelines that can make the applicability a little awkward to understand, and I'll try to get a what I'd call a wiring diagram to show how that applicability works. So with that, Mr. Chairman, unless you have other questions, that's pretty much the rollout.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Any questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Coghill, as you look at what's gone on here, I guess one of the first things that you mentioned earlier on was that it was going to be $420 million saved. Is that per year?
It's a little less than that. I think as you look at the bill, it's hard for us to look beyond 5 years. I think $150 million is what the department's going to come in, OMB. But it's right around $400 million if you look at it in 10 years, if we stay on track with what this bill looks like.
Thank you, Senator Mr.
Olson.
Chairman.
Go ahead.
As you look at the reason the bill was brought together, and it was obviously to cut down on recidivism, you know, try and reinvest and make sure that we've got that money going to something that's going to pay dividends in the long run, and the overlying is obviously public safety, where we're keeping everybody safe. As you look at some of the issues that are related to the changes that have gone on, the drug testing and those kind of things, who's paying for that drug testing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the way that we're envisioning this to work is that we actually reduce the amount of people in jail on any given time, at any given time. So the reduction, so is a savings. And so what I've asked the committee is to consider those savings as reinvestment dollars into everything from drug and alcohol programs to new members on the pretrial agency within the Department of Corrections. So the idea is if we can demonstrate a savings of, let's just say, 100 beds, and they're times 150, take the marginal savings of that and invest that into programs that are valuable, then I think that that we will have a safer society. So I think probably the better way to look at it is to let OMB come up with what they consider from the, where the bill is, because I'm speaking now from just memory, and that may be dangerous.
And the question I asked, though, was, as we look at costs, the question of drug testing that has been incorporated now into the bill, who pays for that is my real question.
Go ahead, Senator Cockett.
It'll be through granting the state, pure and simple, the state. What we're going to do is, we know there's no new money in Alaska. There's just not going to be. So we have to save money in order to reinvest it. And that's what the reinvestment part of this, when you hear about justice reinvestment, you're taking your savings and let's just say taking half of it, 50%, 60%, whatever you think can actually work to make a safer society, and reinvesting it and actually pocketing the savings by just spending less in government. And so I think that $150 million is what the anticipated savings are over the next 5 years. So then it's a matter of what can we reinvest from there.
So if the state's paying for the drug testing that's going on, as you look at the other issue of public assistance that's out there, that as you start to go ahead and take public assistance away from those people that have failed the drug test, that I think is going to be another expense that's going to be on the state. Is that correct?
There's two ways of looking at that. If you go off of public assistance, there's less cost to the state. If you stay on public assistance, then the state is safer. So there's probably a couple ways of looking at it. The same thing is true of the food stamps. Right now, if you are convicted of murder, you can get out of jail and go get on food stamps. But if you're convicted of a drug crime, you can't get on food stamps. And the very people that we want them to be successful try to get those food stamps to them. But it's also true that the programs that they're going to go to are meant to help them stay off of the drugs and alcohol. Right now we have food service workers, public safety workers, people working in mines, people driving trucks who have to take random drug testing. And what we're asking is if you're going to try to make a public safer, then we want you to be subject to random drug testing if you're going to be on that assistance once you're convicted of a drug crime.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator.
I'm certainly not saying that some of it should or shouldn't be drug tested. I'm just saying that I want to know what the concepts are, because obviously public assistance has both the federal component as well as the state component to it, and so that idea that people should be drug tested, that's another argument. I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I think the Department of Health and Social Services is going to come up with a budget recommendation, because it's a new concept, so they're not 100% sure what it may be. So there'll probably be a positive and a negative. If they stay on and you get the public safer, it may cost you more. If they go off, you might actually save money, but are your safety benefits there? And those are the things that we'll have to consider as we move through that particular issue. And their fiscal note probably will reflect that.
Other questions? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair.
Does the bill contemplate any categories that are currently criminal behavior that's currently, well, viewed as criminal behavior with sanctions applied to it, et cetera, et cetera? Does the bill contemplate that any of those, that type of behavior or any behaviors will be no longer considered criminal? In other words, are there any laws that are going to be changed that might have a criminal behavior delisted?
Probably the, I'm going to go from memory here, but we reduced some B misdemeanors down to citations. Very, very few. We started off with more, but what we found out was the criminal behavior, we needed the ability to arrest. So it's down to very small things, like removing cones on a highway project or something like that, which still can be dangerous, but you can at least cite people. And then the other thing is, in some of the controlled substances, they're still criminal, but the way they're handled might be differently. For example, a felony controlled substance, in this particular bill, we talked about those who are low-level users, but they still have significant amount. They would probably, at that point, be not in the felony range. But if they have a certain amount that looks like they're trying to sell it, and they are selling it for habit, then they would be a low-level felony. And if they have more, I think the cutoff point that we put in here was 2.5 grams. If they have more than that, then they're a C felony. So it's different the way we're handling it. And I think the idea is to hold people accountable, but if they're low level, get them into a drug program first. If they're high level, then they're a greater scourge and should be handled differently. And I think you'll see a difference in the way we handle it, but not the fact that they're a felony. It's still a felony now, and it will be a felony later.
Senator Dunleavy?
Well, Chair, does the bill contemplate additional expectations put on public schools? Last year we had a couple bills that were passed to teach and inform students proper relationships, recognizing signs of sexual abuse, et cetera. Does this bill contemplate any additional expectations on public schools?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dunleavy, no.
Senator Cog, oh, never mind, go ahead. I was just going to ask if you needed a lifeline anytime, you can go ahead and pull it in.
One last one.
Senator Dunleavy.
Do you have any idea how much money is going to be reinvested in treatment compared to Victims' Rights Commission?
You'll see a list from Office of Management Budget. There's a recommendation that $100 million of the $150 goes into programs. You'll get a chance to look at the rationale on that. I don't know that that's the exact right number. And there's probably some what I would call fluid discussion on whether it should go into pretrial services, into drug and alcohol services, whether it should be mental health, how it should be handled with granting. Those types of things. We put the language in there that it can be done, and I think at this point the amount of savings is open for discussion as the way it's dispersed is open for discussion.
Just one last question.
Dunleavy?
It's a large bill. You put a lot of time into it. You've had at least one other committee referral hear it. What feedback are you getting in just macro categories in which you have who would be in what groups would be in opposition to the bill in its current form? I know it's gone through some different changes, but what would be some groups that would oppose the bill?
Senator Coghill, before you answer, I just want the record to reflect that Senator Bishop has joined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I can answer that fairly well. I was on a radio program the other day, and I can tell you there are some victim advocates that feel like the sentencing structure is just too loose. But they're already complaining about what's in place right now. And like I said earlier, the sentencing contemplates that the way you hold people accountable would be different under risk assessments. That doesn't happen now. But I think the people who feel like they've been so violated by either a sexual assault or somebody's death are so displeased with our judicial system, and they feel that this might be going lighter on that on two accounts. One of them on the actual sentencing ranges, because a couple of years ago, Supreme Court handed us a law called Blakely that that we had to deal with, which said that aggravators and mitigators had to be argued at the final sentencing. And we went in the judiciary, in our legislature, we went to the highest range and made that the bottom of the range. And what the commission recommended is that we make that the middle of the range. And that is disturbing to some people because they feel that that's being light on crime. But what they don't take into account is both between pretrial services, the good time behavior issues, and the supervision, that there will be risk assessment tools that have never been used before. The ability for victims to chime in on probation, parole, the idea that the court has to contact victims even when they're either coming up for a new hearing or even in the pretrial circumstances. So it's hard to compare those, but we did go to the mid-range, and it's really based on the tool that we used that evaluated across the United States that the sentencing does not bring us any better safety outcomes. And so they thought holding them accountable differently was better safety outcomes than just having the highest range. The other place that I would say is the sexual assault area. There have been so many people victimized in Alaska, and they're just tired of it. They're so angry, and I get that they're so disappointed that somebody might be able to get into a plea bargaining deal and have a light sentence when they're totally been violated so deeply in their life that there just seems to be no justice and no satisfaction in justice. And I get that. I think that's a very important thing. And so all along the way, we've tried to say, when there's a sex offender issue here, how do you treat the most egregious ones more appropriately? How do you treat those ones that can turn from that behavior? How do you give them opportunity? And like I said, the probation parole is one of the places. The earned good time is another place where we've tightened that up. Getting the sex offender treatment inside the jail is very, very important. So I think we've been pretty responsive to it on everything from the charging to the way they earn good time, to the way they're held accountable under parole. I think we've handled that fairly well. But the system we have right now is violating people, unfortunately. And I don't know that we're going to be able to make a system that will forever say that we will stop that kind of abuse. We just need to hold people accountable when they do have that record of abuse. And I think that what we've accounted for in this bill gets us there. And probably the last place is we've upped the threshold of the dollar amount for property theft. And some people, I think in Matsu, who have actually got a group called Valley Thieves, Stop Valley Thieves, I think, they were concerned that that in handling these, the misdemeanors would not be handled properly. And I disagree with them, but I totally understand when somebody is stolen from, how violated you feel. But the inordinate amount of $750, the value between a rural area and an urban area is so great that it seemed inappropriate to set in line a whole felony system where you have a grand jury, a jury trial, and it's a hammer for bargaining, but it puts us in a position where we're continually bargaining down felonies rather than holding people accountable for felonies as they really are. So I think if we're going to use the felony tool, it should be for felons. And if we're going to use the misdemeanor tools, we should use it wisely. And retribution and remuneration should be, people should pay back. I think should be paid back. So I think those are the tools we should use more often. And so this bill kind of sets that in motion. And that's why the risk assessment tools, the accountability tools are important, including getting a driver's license back. How are you going to pay restitution if you can't work, for example? And so I think those are the three areas that I would say I get most of the pushback. And a lot of it sounds really good if you only take one portion of the bill and you really highlight it and you take a very dramatic personal circumstance and apply it to it. But it applies to our current law. doesn't take into account the accountability measures we put in this law. So I'm sympathetic to those who feel that we're going to go light. But this is accountability in a very different way. Jail time is what will only satisfy some people. Accountability is something that I'm more interested in, because jail time, if you do a crime and you get in jail and you don't change and you come out exactly the same way, which 95% of the people are doing right now, they come out, if nothing has changed, then you have more criminal. And it's proof positive. We have two-thirds of people coming back for new violations. Something's got to change. And so the accountability measures we put in this bill, I think, coming from the commission, proven practices, very well thought, very credible people putting them together, and I get to be the person who gets to carry that along. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I had a late plane, didn't get in here, and I might have missed this, but you just, to Senator Coghill, you just mentioned 95% of the prisoners come out, and they're in no better than when they went back. You know, and they come back out on the street, and they reoffend, and they go back in. So with that being said, has the Texas model been in place long enough to get any statistical data to that their overhaul proves otherwise, that they're, you know, that it's working or not working? Or you have any comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, the answer is yes. I'm not prepared to go through all the statistics, but what I can do is I can give you a review of all the different recommendations from the commission showing the statistical review that they did do, and I can make that available to the committee. I think you'll find it rather interesting. Also, if you take a look at the report, which is it's dense, I get that, but if you would take time to read that report, you'll see that the national statistical review that they did, plus the review they did at the stats from our Department of Corrections and our own court system, show that we have lots of room that we can change in and still live up to the statistical review that that I would say yes to on that. So the commission report, I think, is very, very good on that. And the Pew, to their credit, the Pew organization did do that. But they were reviewed by the commission, not the Pew group. And they took a good hard look at it, and I can say with some degree of even skepticism, and still came to a conclusion I thought was very, very well grounded.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Senator Dunleavy.
To the chair, how does the proposed language to reduce charges for drug possession compare with that of other states?
Lifeline.
I need a lifeline. Mr. Chairman, maybe if I could get Jordan Schilling to come up here.
Line up, Jordan. State your name and affiliation.
Finally you got it.
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. I don't know a whole lot about how other states do drug sentencing. I know that there is a variety of states that treat simple possession as a misdemeanor. I'm sure there are states that do what Senate Bill 91 envisions, which is to differentiate between high-level drug dealers and low-level drug dealers and sentence them accordingly. But I can have the commission take a look, 50-state look, and get back to you.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just to follow, has the change in our marijuana laws impacted the discussion on the bill in that particular area, drug possession? And if so, to what degree?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the commission didn't really contemplate addressing marijuana sentencing.
Questions? So next time the bill is up, is that when we're going to go through the sexual? Was that your anticipation?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're going to go through sectional, but it'll be based on category,
correct,
like pretrial sentencing, community supervision, because it you have to touch several sections of the bill in order to deal with one of those categories. But it will do like the risk-based decision-making in pretrial, even though it deals with like eight sections of the bill, you'll be able to tie it together. Sure. And you'll look at the operative pieces and then those sections that are conforming for the most part.
So we will come back and hear this bill. Aaron, when is it that Senator McKinnon is going to have this up? On Tuesday, tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I think you had a couple of people to testify, but I need to excuse myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought these were for questions.
And I am supposed to be chairing the Judiciary Committee as we speak.
Right.
So I will need to excuse myself if you have no further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Coghill. We'll take a brief at ease.
We're back on Senate Bill 91. Senator Kelly had to step out for just a moment, and who we have today for invited testimony first is Greg Razzo, Chair of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. Mr. Razzo, if you can please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gregory Razzo. I'm a Vice President at Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. I've worked at SERI for 11 years. SERI allows me to have the time to do this important work for the state of Alaska. I serve as chair of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. I'm also vice chair of the Alaska Native Justice Center. I'm chairman of the Executive Governance Committee of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And justice policy is something that I strongly believe in. I've been a lawyer for 31 years in Alaska. I was an active practicing everyday and court lawyer for the first 21 years through about 2005 when I went to work for SERI. So I know what a courtroom looks like. I've been in it a lot, and it's the striving, I guess, for the best rule of law that really brings me into this room here today. I want to explain a little bit about the Criminal Justice Commission before we go into the specific policies. But the Criminal Justice Commission, when the legislature conceived it, really conceived all aspects of people involved in criminal justice, every level of the court system, the public defender and the attorney general, a law enforcement officer, a victim's rights representative, myself for Alaska Native people, and the commissioners of public safety and corrections, as well as the two non-voting members of the legislature. So you had every point of view involved, and one of the things that we did, and I do as chairman of the commission, is work by consensus. And I don't mean a majority of the vote when I talk about consensus. When our recommendations came to the legislature, they were the consensus of every commissioner. We all signed off on the recommendations as something that we could live with, that represented the best thinking that was presented to the commission. And we presented our recommendations after having worked on them for about 9 months, and they're based upon evidence. So we wanted to present sound public policy recommendations on criminal justice that were supported by evidence. And I think that's what we tried to do, and that's what we did. So we looked at the drivers of the prison population in Alaska. And the first statistic that came up was our recidivism rate. So I'm a businessman, and in Alaska, the recidivism rate is every 2 out of 3 people that are released from prison go back to prison within 3 years. So it doesn't take an expert to tell you that simply is not a good return on investment. It's a waste of money somewhere. So why are all the people coming into prison? Why are they staying in prison longer and longer than ever before?
what are the drivers of the prison population? We took a look at that. We looked at lots of statistics, and then we looked at lots of studies regarding those statistics, and then we came and split into three groups, pretrial, sentencing, and post-conviction, because the amount of data was simply that large that we had to split it up to do anything rational with it. And each of the groups took a very detailed, deep dive into the statistics and into the evidence and came up with their set of policies, which were then presented several times to the full commission until we came to consensus. So it was a real methodical process, I'd like to say. And when we came up with our recommendations, we were guided by public safety as the driving factor. It wasn't simply about reducing the number of people that were in prison, because we believe that you can increase public safety when you reduce recidivism. And looking at methods that reduce recidivism through expenditures on justice reinvestment, spending money that you save from taking non-serious offenders out of prison and doing something differently with them, such as treatment, such as prevention, such as oversight once they're in the community, having been released from prison, those sorts of things that don't cost as much as prison, the evidence shows actually gets you better results at the end of the day. So I'll talk about what our recommendations were and what some of those results are. So the first recommendation that we made dealt with a sentencing recommendation to limit the use of prison for low-level misdemeanor offenses. So here in Alaska, we had a statistic. We were stunned by the large number of misdemeanor offenders, even low-level misdemeanor offenders who are sentenced to prison every year. 67% of all admissions into prison were for nonviolent misdemeanors. And then 82% of all admissions into prison were for misdemeanor offenses. Not felony offenses, not the most serious offenses, but for misdemeanors. So we have a lot of people coming in for nonviolent misdemeanors, two-thirds of the people admitted every day. These people cycle in and out of the prison system, out of the correction system. They take up tremendous amounts of time and money. I can tell you, I was a misdemeanor prosecutor and a misdemeanor defense lawyer, and every day we would see the same people cycle in and out, in and out. They weren't receiving treatment, and that situation exists to this day. And you would have to see the same people over and over again, and their sentence would slowly get bigger and bigger and bigger. But their recidivism was you know, it's 100%. It was in and out, in and out. So are we spending our money here in Alaska on serious offenses, and are we doing things that will drive down that recidivism rate? This cycling in and out of offenders is simply a waste of money. So we adopted a number of evidence-based strategies to divert certain misdemeanor offenses through diversion programs that would divert them into prison alternatives, okay? And that's by reclassifying. So we did make a recommendation to reclassify low-level B misdemeanors into violations, into non-criminal infractions, because we're simply spending a lot of money on low-level B misdemeanors. 26 days is an average prison sentence for some of those low-level B misdemeanors. So 26 days for the least serious offense in the state of Alaska.
Senator Dunleavy.
Chair, can you give us some examples of the type of misdemeanors you're referring to?
So B misdemeanors, common B misdemeanors, something like disorderly conduct, something like theft in the fourth degree, could be disorderly conduct is really, it's a big one. I mean, that's fighting in a bar, you know, you get arrested for disorderly conduct, and there's just a laundry list of B misdemeanors. But essentially, the idea is that these people spend a lot of time in prison, which costs a lot of money, and
you're not reducing their proclivity to go back and forth to jail over and over again. And it's simply, at the end of the day, from the commission's point of view, isn't where that money should be spent. There's more serious things that should be done with the money that could be used with that money, rather than spending your time on recycling B misdemeanor offenders. So that's one example. I can provide additional examples for Senator Dunleavy through the chair.
So do we have a higher rate of, quote, behaviors that in other states would be considered criminal behaviors, or is it that in Alaska we have a higher rate of behaviors that we in Alaska consider criminal behaviors? In other words, I'm trying to find out if it's the actual classification of the law, or is it the behavior here would be considered behavior issues in other states? Mm-hmm.
I can just offer an opinion through the chair.
Mr. Rather, in
my opinion, our laws are consistent with the laws of other states. I don't think we have more crimes necessarily than other states. What we do have going on here, and the reason that we brought the commission together, is that we're finding that over time, and especially over the last 10 years, people are staying in jail longer for the same offenses. So we're not having more new offenses, and we don't have more crimes than anyone else. We just have people staying in jail longer than we ever have before. And that's what drives up the prison population and the cost of prison. So, you know, we went and tried to look at why people were staying in jail longer, and that brought us to the felony level offenses. So when I practiced in 2005, we had presumptive sentencing. And I could tell my client, if I was a defense lawyer, or I could tell the defendant, if I was the district attorney, the presumptive amount of time for this offense is 5 years if it's a C felony. And then you would have an argument over whether it was an aggravated or a mitigated offense, and the judge would decide what the ultimate sentence was going to be, if he was going to divert from the presumptive 5 years, or if he was going to say, no, the presumptive sentence is the set by the legislature, and that's what the sentence is going to be. Well, after 2005, the next year, the U.S. Supreme Court had a case come before it called Blakely. And in the Blakely case, what they said was that this idea of mitigators and aggravators, that's something that's so serious that the defendant has a right to have a jury trial, not just the judge decide whether it's aggravated or mitigated, but you have to have a jury trial if you're going to have a presumptive sentence of 5 years and then aggravated. So sentencing is in the province of the jury, basically. So the Alaska legislature dealt with that by putting in a presumptive range of sentences. Okay, so in C felonies, for example, the presumptive range where the sentence used to be 5 years, the presumptive range changed to 5 to 10 years, I believe what it was. I've got a chart that shows what all those changes were. And the consequence of setting this range of sentences for each of the felony offenses ended up being, over the 10-year period, that the courts tended to sentence people at the high end of the range. So for the same crime that existed in 2005, it was going to be sentenced, say, in 2007, after Blakely, the odds are that defendant was actually going to get the aggravated sentence instead of the presumptive sentence now, as a matter of course. So you end up having criminals stay in prison for longer and longer periods of time, over 10 years. And in sex offenders, because we were particularly tough on sex offenders, their sentences in some cases, they at least doubled, but many of them tripled and quadrupled and even five times the sentence that existed before for sex offenders. And significantly, the opportunity for sex offenders to be eligible for either good time or discretionary parole was taken away. So what we're seeing right now is that we've got an explosion in sex offenders in prison, and those folks, under the current law, are not eligible for any sort of reduction in their sentence, regardless of whether they do treatment in prison or not.
And what we found in our science, just to go to the sex offender question, and I'm off topic a little bit, but what we found was is that sex offender treatment generally works. It doesn't cure people, but it teaches people about boundaries, and then if you allow them back into the community with intense supervision, the fact that they now understand about boundaries, regardless of whether they may or may not continue to have the desires that brought them into prison in the first place, but simply teaching them about appropriate boundaries and some understanding of what is and what is considered is and is not considered correct behavior in society, something that many of them may not have ever been taught before or simply needed to be emphasized with this population, that actually works. And you know, as much as it is certainly righteous to be angry about sex offenders, are probably one of our most significant problems in this state, we're not treating them in prison at the rate we should be, and we don't incentivize them to do treatment, and we don't make it easier for them to get treatment and have very strict supervision, which works when they're released. So, off topic a little bit, but I hope that answers some of your question.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at some of the, obviously the recidivism is the big thing that we're dealing with here, and that seems to, if we could handle that or get a clue of what's going on there. Now, is there a difference between recidivism in the rural part of Alaska as opposed to the urban parts of Alaska?
Well, what we know is the overall recidivism rate, and I don't know if we can break it down for Alaska Natives, for example. What we do know for sure, though, is that Alaska Natives make up, if the population of Alaska Natives in Alaska is 15%, they're represented in prison 36%. And I can tell you, this is just the personal experience that I had on the commission. We had a chance, because we really wanted to do outreach. It wasn't built into our budgets, but we were able to piggyback on the Mental Health Trust a little bit and go out to Nome and Kotzebue and go into the prison at Anvil Mountain Correctional Center. And while I'd been to jails before in my work, I hadn't been to that facility before, and I really didn't know what to expect. I'd been to prisons before, but going to Anvil Mountain was really a life-changing event for me in many ways, because when we walked in, we first met the staff, who I thought was a very dedicated group of professionals in the Department of Corrections. They all knew what their jobs were. They had tough jobs. Then we walked in and we saw the first set of cells, which was devoted to people that were mentally ill. They were in there because they were mentally ill and they were a danger to themselves. And instead of getting these people treated, or because they needed to be detoxed, they're in the prison, which seemed just wrong to me. I mean, if these people had a health problem or a mental health problem, why aren't they in a place where they can get treatment instead of just sleeping it off in prison? Then we went into the prison itself, where there was two mods of prisoners, two big groups of cells. And when I walked into the prison, I would say 98% of the people incarcerated in Anvil Mountain Correctional Center were Alaska Natives. I looked for any non-Native faces that I could see in that crowd of people. And there was a lot of people. There's probably 250 people, maybe more, in that prison. And I saw a couple, maybe. So the next day, we had a chance to go and talk to the prisoners, and I just wanted to ask a couple questions. So I had a chance to talk with the Commissioner of Corrections. He said, go ahead and ask them a couple questions in a town hall meeting that we had. So I said, if you're in here because of an alcohol-related offense, would you raise your hand? And everybody but about six people in that prison raised their hands. And then I said, if you're in here for a drug offense, raise your hands. And the other six people raised their hands. And what it told me was that we have an addiction problem of epidemic proportions in Alaska, and particularly with our prison population. And to the extent that it's a problem for Alaska Natives, I will testify that it exists. That's what those people told me in prison. And they're in prison killing time. They're watching TV. They're not reading books because there's only about 20 books in that library. But they're, you know, they're playing cards and they're killing time. And it seemed to me to be the most significant waste of humanity that I've seen in a long time, frankly. So this reinvestment focuses on things like prevention. By the money we save by keeping prison for serious offenders and taking the non-serious offenders out of the system and treating them, we have money for prevention. We have money for treatment. We have money for victim services. You know, all of those things that clearly are under-resourced. I had a chance to talk to all the service providers in Nomenclatsa. You had meetings with them through the trust. And again, group of dedicated professionals working on a shoestring budget. And they want to help more people, but they have significant problems in rural Alaska just because of where they live.
Mr. Chairman, if I could redirect my question again.
Certainly, Senator Olson.
The question that I have is not so much whether it's Alaska Native versus the non-Native population. The question is, what are the hurdles and obstacles that are out there for rural incarcerates or those people that are...
I understand.
...that are faced with those kind of challenges, whether they're from Shungnak or Shishkareff or from Norma Bethel.
Let's talk
As opposed to going down to the pretrial facility there in Anchorage.
Got it. Through the chair... Senator Olson, on the pretrial side, one of the big problems is when somebody gets arrested in rural Alaska, they have to be brought before a judge within 24 hours, and they have to have an arraignment. And the way we do things right now, that means the Department of Public Safety has to go out, pick up the arrested person, fly them to wherever there's a court so that they can get an arraignment, and then they're either released or they're incarcerated. Generally, they're incarcerated. But if they're released, the court will go through a hearing process to determine whether bail is appropriate. And so a lot of our recommendations talk about bail as well. But the problem is that if they're released in Anchorage, for example, and they're allowed the opportunity for ankle monitoring, let's say, those services aren't available in rural Alaska. So you have to have some alternative out in rural Alaska that's going to work as well, and that could be some sort of community supervision.
So it's effect on recidivism.
It is. And it's on the front end, it's an effect on the prison population in general because you have more people from rural Alaska unable to get out of prison because they can't meet conditions of bail. They can't make bail. In Alaska, bail requires the submittal of money bonds. And what we found is that actually an unsecured bond, which is merely the promise to pay if you break your bail, that is as effective as paying money. You wouldn't believe that, but that's what the evidence it clearly shows, is that unsecured bonds are just as effective as money bail. But we need the law changed so that we can try to implement that. But that's been implemented in a number of other states successfully. On the back end...
Mr. Razzo?
Yes, sir.
We might be a little bit pressed for time.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I don't know if you had more testimony that you wanted to complete.
I'll say that you know, in covering the large amount of topics that we had to cover as a commission, if nothing else, I want to impress upon you that SB 91 was originally based upon evidence. As it changes and goes through this process and the legislative process, I urge you to ask yourself whether the amendments that come onto this bill are evidence-based. If they're not evidence-based, then you shouldn't consider them. If they're purely driven by emotion or by somebody's anger at being the victim of crime, while that's legitimate, ask yourself at the end of the day if the criminal justice process is going to have evidence-based law or not. And I would say evidence-based law is what we recommend. It makes sense, and there's actually evidence to support the original Criminal Justice Commission recommendations. So.
Thank you, Mr. Razzo. Any more questions for Mr. Razzo from committee members? Yeah, Senator Bishop.
Just a quick one. He pretty much asked it, but I just wanted to say, you know, the two out of three prisoners, they returned to prison in 3 years. I think you pretty much summed up your question, my question in the Anvil Mountain, two questions to the population, but as this evidence-based process has been played out, how much interface with the prisoners was done?
So all of our...
Asking them, if you will, why are you going back to prison?
So we did the Anvil Mountain experience. The evidence that we took in wasn't going out and talking to prisoners. It was mostly looking at very high-level studies and seeing what, you know, studies of studies said, and taking a look at the actual statistics of why people are in jail here in Alaska. So it was much more statistical and numbers-based than anecdotal evidence from prisoners. But I mean, those two questions, I think, that I asked kind of hit the nail on the head to a huge degree.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Razzo. Chris Sell, Lieutenant with the General Police Department, is also a member of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. Chris, feel free to identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Chris Sell. My regular job, my daytime job, often nighttime job, is a lieutenant at the Juneau Police Department. I am not here representing the Juneau Police Department or the Alaska Peace Officer Association, of which I am vice president, because there's a lot of discussion about those bills in the circle. It's a complicated area, and we're going to discuss that in more detail. But I did serve as a commissioner throughout this process, and I'm going to take a few minutes to tell you a little bit about the process that I went through. You've heard from Senator Coghill and our chairman Greg Razzo, and you're probably thinking, at least I hope you're thinking, that they've told you that this was a really important, productive, kind of wonderful process. Well, it wasn't. It was horrible. It was actually painful. There were times I was literally sick to my stomach. And it's not because what we were doing wasn't important and all those other things. It's because it was so painful to go from really believing in the tough on crime mantra that so many of us grew up with. I see a lot of people in this room that are about the same age that I am. And it's some of the first political speeches I remember sitting in a farmhouse in Montana was that politicians said we had to get tough on crime, and boy, that sounded awesome. I mean, why wouldn't you want to get tough on crime? Everybody hates crime. Nobody wants criminals out there hurting people. And for a while, getting tough on crime did make a difference. There's statistical proof that it did. But when I joined the Criminal Justice Commission, I had to start reevaluating, and it was a tough place to go, because when I asked for the time to leave Juneau and go serve on the Criminal Justice Commission, I said to myself, and I even said to others, I'm going to go make sure they don't let people out of prison. Here, hold my coat. I'll be back. And I went in there viewing myself as the person that was going to keep people in prison. So it was a difficult transition for me to acknowledge the evidence, to acknowledge what we were learning, that we really had to invest in rehabilitating people because we were literally a criminalizing, victim-creating factory in Alaska. We would put people in prison, they would get worse, we would turn them out, they would victimize again, and we would put them in prison for a longer period. And I participated in this myself more times than I can count, arresting the same people over and over and over again. And you know, by the fifth or sixth time you arrest somebody and they're living in a broken down car in the Walmart parking lot, they're really dangerous because they don't have anything left to lose. All of their ties have been cut, their housing is gone, they're unemployable. And they can become very scary individuals. And as a police officer, I said, well, this person just isn't getting it. We keep throwing them in prison, and they keep not getting it. They keep coming out of prison and going back to doing drugs and committing crimes and hurting other people. We better throw them in longer and see if that works. And that's what we've been doing. And it didn't work. And instead, they kept getting worse. And I've watched them get worse. I've watched them deteriorate so many times. And now that I've been exposed to the evidence, I had to rethink some of those experiences and think, you know, maybe the first or second or third time we put them in prison, maybe we should have looked at why they were there. Was it because their criminal activity was tied to their drug abuse? They were stealing things to pay for drugs or becoming impaired on alcohol and then doing things that hurt people? Maybe we should start, as the commission has found there's evidence of it working, that we really look at people when they come into the system and try and address what's going on with that individual. So the evolution was very, very difficult for me. I remember I had a few exchanges during the commission with the defense attorney on the commission, who's in this room, Quinlan Steiner, and we had some difficult discussions, but of course we were professional. I trust him enough to let him sit directly behind me here. So one interaction I remember very specifically is we had been working all day going through issue after issue that talked about putting people in jail less so we could reinvest in a different place, and I felt like a sapling tree that the wind was just blowing me over. And I was going farther and farther and farther away from what I thought I was going to defend. And so I just picked a point, and it really didn't matter what it was. I think it was probation, and the statistics show people are most likely to violate their probation in the first year. And then the returns of supervising them dip sharply in the second year, because if they can't adjust to being law-abiding citizens, that generally becomes obvious fairly quickly. But I just picked that point, and I pushed back, and I said, I want 2 years. And Quinlan said, well, what is it about the data? What are you achieving in that second year? And I felt myself, I didn't physically do it, but I felt myself mentally cross my arms, lean back, and I just wanted 2 years because one was not a number I could cope with emotionally. So it was more like an auction than an interpretation of the data. And it's easy to have that happen because we're talking about such a massive paradigm shift. And it's so difficult to go from what we all thought we knew about criminal justice, which maximum returns come from maximum incarceration. And that's simply not the case. Difficult to deal with. The statements from the victims are so powerful, and it's so hard to not just agree with everything people want when they have been violated in a way no person should have been violated. And yet, I can't help but think sometimes, were they hurt by someone who had already been to prison? And when that person was in prison before, did we fail to meaningfully alter their behavior so that this person didn't have to be a victim? We are generating victims at such a rate, we've really kind of lost track of how many of them are impacted by repeat offenders, but it's a lot of them because we have so many repeat offenders. So there's been a lot of consternation amongst law enforcement circles. I've been reminded a number of times to say that I'm not representing JPD, CBJ, or APOA. That's right, the insignia has kind of been ripped off my sleeves. But I can't go back to what I wanted to defend in September of 2014, because the tricky part about education is you can't unlearn what you now know. So as you go through this process, you may experience some of the same things I did. You're going to be confronted with the evidence, and the evidence may give you a feeling in the pit of your stomach that you don't like. Things like not having secured bail. I mean, I know intellectually somebody's willingness to reoffend and willingness to abscond has nothing to do with how much money they have. Lots of people with money, including those in the drug trade, are some of our highest risk offenders. And yet, when you look at that section about unsecured bail, it's emotionally difficult to cope with that. And it will be emotionally difficult for other people. So I get all the pushback. I lived through all of it. And I might sometimes ask myself, was this really worth it? I mean, going to this commission, I had really wonderful trips to Anchorage, slogging through the slush downtown to go to the commission meetings. And it was worth it because doing the right thing is more important than doing the popular thing. So you, too, will be confronted with that at times during this discussion. So with that, I won't bore you with my details anymore.
Senator Bishop. Thanks for coming and giving us your takeaways on the process. But I'm a little confused. Your opening statement, you said it was a horrible process. So, but as I listen to you talk about the process, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, it appears that maybe you've become a believer a little bit on what the data has shown. Am I accurate?
That is correct. But letting go of those comforting feelings about what I thought I knew was really difficult. It would have been a lot more fun to put on my Get Tough on Crime t-shirt and go to the gym and not think about it anymore, but I can't go back to that place now. So I had to go through my own education process, and I had to give up a lot of things that felt good in order to follow the information.
Thank you. Any other questions? If you have any wrap-up comments, I before you go, I just want to say that I co-sponsored this bill, and I've paid the price for it from the folks on the other side. There were some things added to the bill that I wanted to see, like the spice-related consequences. But it is a paradigm shift, and I the primary draw for me was the fact that what we're doing is simply not working, and it's not working more and more every day.
It is,
which is a strange way to phrase that, but you know what I mean. We have to look for a better result.
No, we're generating more hardened criminals and more recidivism every day, and we have to make a choice. Are we going to try and make people feel like they're safe? Or are we going to do something to make them actually safe? And that's going to be our legacy, whether we manage to do that or not. So, I'm up for re-election for the Peace Officers Association in May, and I'm not having new business cards printed just yet.
Thank you, Ms. Sell. Appreciate it, Lieutenant. Mr. Schilling, do you have anything in wrap-up? Well, we're going to hear and hold this bill anyway, so we've heard the bill. We're going to hold it, set it aside. Tomorrow's meeting at 9 a.m. is Senate Bill 91, Omnibus Crime Law and Procedure. We'll have further discussion on this bill. And then tomorrow afternoon's bill at 1 p.m. is the TERS Contribution, Community Assistance, and Alaska Performance Scholarship Bills. So with that, we are adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.